Introduction. In his beautiful peroration at the end of his sermon, The Weight of Glory, C.S. Lewis, after commenting on the immortality of the human soul, says, "This does not mean that we are to be perpetually solemn. We must play. But our merriment must be of that kind, and it is in fact the merriest kind, which exists between people who have, from the outset, taken each other seriously." I believe that this and similar encouragements by Lewis contribute significantly to the subject of what constitutes Christian behaviour. Having done the best we can to perform whatever God demands, should we not at least enjoy the good he sends us? Willing ourselves to be perpetually solemn when there is no reason for it seems to me not only a rejection of the happiness we could have on earth, but also to jeopardize our capacity to enjoy it in the future when every possible reason for unhappiness has been finally swept away. We know from his earliest writings that Lewis was born with a sense of fun, and that it was considerably maimed by an entanglement of atheism and ambition. Perhaps a fiercely serious ambition, for whatever it might be, can never live in harmony with the merriment he describes. Certainly, Lewis could write no great works until he was converted to Christianity in 1931, after which he ceased to take much interest in himself. If it is objected by those of a lugubrious disposition that the Christian religion is serious and of great solemnity, then my answer is, yes, of course, and not taken seriously enough. But Lewis comes to our rescue at this point by showing us in his book The Four Loves how easily things can become other than they should be through the wrong kind of seriousness. In editing these essays, I have been led to reflect on that ever mysterious but instinctive notion we seem to be born with that tells us just how merry, how serious, how whatever you will, we know we can be with someone else. My relation to Lewis may be similar to that of others, but it can't be exactly like. As this book is being edited primarily for Americans, I should explain that after I had corresponded with Lewis for some years, he invited me to come over in the spring of 1963 from my native United States for what I hoped would be as much as a single conversation over a cup of tea. I don't believe in luck, but I do believe in angels. And the coveted tea party turned out to be, if it needs a name, The Observations of a Late Arrival, or A Single Summer with CSL. In any event, as the sources of our first-hand evidence about him decrease with the years, I hope that mine will be of some interest to those who feel as I do about that merriment of the merriest kind, of which there seems no abundance these days. It took some time for an American such as myself to adapt to English conveniences. I see, for instance, from my diary of the 7th of June 1963, that during a longish visit with Lewis, we drank what seemed gallons of tea. After a while, I asked to be shown the bathroom, forgetting that in most homes, the bathroom and the toilet are separate rooms. With a kind of mock formality, Lewis showed me to the bathroom, pointed to the tub, flung down a pile of towels, and closed the door behind me. I returned to his sitting room to say that it was not a bath I wanted, but, "Well, sir, choose you this day," said Lewis, bursting with laughter as he quoted the prophet Joshua. "That will break you of those silly American euphemisms. And now, where is it you wanted to go?" I see from other entries I made that Lewis, or Jack, as he preferred to be called by his friends, and I were meeting at least three or four times a week, sometimes at his house, at other times in a pub with a group of friends called the Inklings. I knew that he was ill, indeed, that he had been so since 1961, when the troubles with his health began. He, however, seemed to think little of it, and as he looked so robust, it was easy to forget it when in company with this ruddy, 6-foot, genial man. Hence the surprise of finding him not well enough to attend Mass with me on July the 14th. He urged me to remain there with him. And this was a memorable day for me in more ways than one. It was then that he asked me to accept immediately a post as his literary assistant and personal secretary. And later, after resigning my teaching position at the University of Kentucky, to return to Oxford to resume my duties. Lewis went for a routine examination the next morning to the Ackland nursing home, and, much to everyone's surprise, he sank into a coma lasting about 24 hours, from which the doctors did not believe he would recover. Our mutual friends, the Reverend Dr. Austin Farrer and his wife, were to be on holiday in Wales from the 16th through the 31st of July, but at Lewis's request they remained in Oxford until the 17th, so that Austin Farrer could hear his confession and give him the Blessed Sacrament. Lewis wanted me to receive the sacrament with him, but as I was not ill, this was not allowed. "In that case," Lewis said, "you must be present to do the kneeling for me." With so much to do for him at this time, I was unable to keep a regular diary. However, I see from a letter I wrote to the Farrers on July the 30th from Lewis's home, and now part of the Farrer papers in the Bodleian Library, Oxford, that I had already moved into Lewis's home by that time. Rather than tell Lewis how close he had come to dying, the doctors appeared to leave this to me. When I judged the time to be right, I told him about the coma and the few days when his mind was disordered. Thereafter, Lewis continued to believe that the extreme unction administered during the coma and his reception of the Blessed Sacrament had saved his life. Even before he went into the nursing home, I marvelled that Lewis had lived so long without setting himself ablaze. Except when he dressed for a special occasion, he wore an old tweed jacket, the right-hand pocket of which had been patched and repatched many times. This was because Lewis, when wearied of his pipe, would drop it into his pocket, with the result that it would burn its way through. And this happened so often that there was none of the original material left. The nurses in the Ackland, having found him nodding with a cigarette in his hand, would have none of this. And so it was that, except when I was with him, they would not allow him to have any matches. What puzzled Lewis was that, after I had left him with a box of matches, a nurse would, as soon as I left, rush in and take them away. "How do they know?" he asked me one morning. "Give me a box I can hide under my bedclothes." I had then to confess that, while I was the supplier, I was also the informer. "Informer!" roared Lewis. "I have what no friend ever had before. I have a private traitor. My very own personal Benedict Arnold. Repent before it is too late." I loved all the rough and tumble of this, and I fancy I pulled his leg about as often as he pulled mine. But there was the gentler side that was just as typical. There was one incident that took place in the Ackland which the readers of his Narnian stories might find as endearing as I did. It occurred on one of those days when Lewis's mind was disordered, and when, as I noticed, he could not recognize any of those who dropped in to see him, not even Professor Tolkien. The last visitor of the day was his foster sister, Maureen Moore Blake, who a few months previously, and by a very unexpected turn of events, had become Lady Dunbar of Hempriggs, with a castle and a vast estate in Scotland. She was the first woman in 3 centuries to succeed to a baronetcy. They had not met since this happened, and, hoping to spare her any disappointment, I told her that he had not been able to recognize any of his old friends. He opened his eyes when she took his hand. "Jack," she whispered, "it is Maureen." "No," replied Lewis, smiling. "It is Lady Dunbar of Hempriggs."
"Oh, Jack, how could you remember that?" she asked.
"On the contrary," he said,
"how could I forget a fairy tale?"
One day, when he was obviously much better, but not completely out of danger, he asked why I looked so glum. The reason for the glumness was that, living in our neighbourhood, was a fierce old atheist of about 97 who went out for a brisk walk every day. Whenever we met, he asked if Lewis was still alive, and on receiving my reply that he was indeed quite ill, he invariably said, "Nothing wrong with me. I've got a long time yet." I told Lewis that I was tempted, very strongly tempted, to tell our Lord that I thought it monstrously unfair that he should allow the naughty old atheist to seemingly go on forever, and yet let Lewis, who was only 64, come so close to the point of death. "Mind you," I said, observing Lewis's face cloud over, "I haven't actually said it in my prayers, but I've come pretty close." "And what do you think our Lord would say to that?" Lewis said with a discouraging look. "What? What is that to you?" Anyone who has read St. John, chapter 21, verse 22, our Lord's rebuke to St. Peter, will recognize Lewis's application of it in this instance. And then, tenderly, Lewis comforted me in what I had imagined was his sorrow, but which he knew was mine. The worst over, there was a return of the high spirits and uproarious sense of fun that I found one of the most attractive things about Lewis. But it would take someone of Boswell's talents to give the right idea to the completeness of this remarkable man, to show how naturally the humour blended into the more serious side, and indeed was one of the causes of his greatness of heart, his large intellect, and the most open charity I have ever found in anyone. He was a man, many of us have come to see, of common instincts combined with very uncommon abilities. Perhaps it is worth recording that I just knew, that no matter how long I lived, no matter who else I met, I should never be in the company of such a supremely good human being again. Of all my memories, this is the most indelible, and is certain to remain so. I brought Lewis home on the 6th of August, along with a male nurse, a Scotsman named Alec Ross, whose responsibility it was to stay awake nights should he be needed. Lewis and I had been together almost continuously for 2 months, and I was even more comfortable with him now that we were in the same house. He had not once complained about conditions in the Ackland, excepting, of course, my traitorous behaviour over the appearing and disappearing matches. Certainly, he snuggled back into his familiar surroundings with much pleasure, sensing that he liked being left alone a little while after lunch. I asked if he ever took a nap. "Oh, no," he replied. "But mind you, sometime a nap takes me." He had kept up his dictating of letters during his stay in the Ackland, and although he was able to do more of this at home, he gave as well more attention to the problems which, since 1961, he knew could become worse should he die suddenly. His brother's unfortunate problem with alcohol, and the future of his two stepsons who had, besides losing their mother in 1960, seen other sadnesses as well. But I mention these things because it was then I observed something I had never seen in anyone else, excepting, as I was to learn later, his friend Owen Barfield. Lewis had his share, some would say more than his share, of worries. But, having done all in his power to solve them, he left the matter to God and got on with his work and pleasures. Those who go on to read, for example, the additions to his sermon Transposition, of which more later, will perhaps understand what may sound like sweet banality but isn't. That Lewis really wanted and liked the happiness which the divine Son died to give all men. And this I observed at the time, some 10 years before I saw in the Bodleian the whole thing put so succinctly in a letter to his brother of the 28th of January 1940, in which he says, "I begin to suspect that the world is divided not only into the happy and the unhappy, but into those who like happiness and those who, odd as it seems, really don't. Without meaning any offence, I suspect that those who carry on about social consciousness, or whatever the current jargon is, would not understand this. Still, that is the way it was." Our nurse hardly knew what to make of Lewis. Alec was not a learned man, but he was fortunate in being one of the few male nurses at that time. And for this reason, he had been able to pick and choose his patients, nearly always with an eye as to whether they were fabulously rich, famous for something or the other, and, he hoped, possessed of a Rolls Royce. He was a good nurse, but he had a foul tongue. At his first sight of the kitchen, he pronounced the house to be a pigsty, and very quickly had the servants sweeping, mopping, and disinfecting as fast as it could be done. But there remained for him the mystifying contradiction of a far from attractive house presided over by a somebody. We were taking our tea alone one day when he asked whether, he couldn't think of the name Who's Who, the Great Mon was in that big book. Lewis was coming through the door, and overhearing this said,
"Aye, aye, Alec. I am in what you in Scotland would call what's what."
That did it. Alec was thereafter devoted to Lewis for his humour and self-forgetfulness, it now making no difference whether Lewis was famous for anything Alec thought important. In August, Lewis dictated a letter announcing his retirement from Cambridge. Then, at the end of the month, with Alec left to keep an eye on Lewis, his stepson, Douglas Gresham, and I were sent to Cambridge to sort out his affairs and bring home many of the 2,000 or so books from his Magdalen College rooms. This done, we hired a lorry to transport us and the books to Oxford. All the way home, I wondered where the books could go in a house already filled to the bursting point. But Lewis had laid his plans. Alec occupied what was called the music room, a large room on the ground floor, empty except for a bed in one corner. Having been up all night, Alec was asleep when we arrived. As the lorry pulled into the drive, there was Lewis cautioning us to be quiet.
"Where'll we store the books?" I whispered.
Lewis answered with a wink. With infinite pains, so as not to waken Alec, we spent an hour or so carrying the books into the music room and stacking them around the nurse's bed. He was still snoring when the last one was added to the great wall of books, which was nearly as high as the ceiling and which filled nearly every square inch of the room. About the time the nurse usually woke, Lewis and I were waiting outside for the results. Then it happened. Alec woke, found himself entombed in books, and bellowed at the top of his voice. Suddenly, part of the great wall of books tumbled down, and a body scrambled out. Over drinks, Alec pronounced it to be the best damned joke he had seen played on anyone. If I have said less than some would wish about Lewis's specifically religious position, that is because I assume that it is already quite clear. Rather, I have tried to indicate from personal recollections that Dr. Johnson might well have had such a man as C.S. Lewis in mind in suggesting that the size of a man's understanding might always be justly measured by his mirth. If I have failed, then the splendid pieces that comprise this collection ought, as they say, to make up for everything. Lewis was a truly modest man. If his books came naturally into our conversation, he would talk about them with the same detachment as in discussing some stranger's works. But he had no interest, as far as I could see, in his literary or theological position in the world. One evening this came up rather naturally. We had been talking about one of our favourite books, Malory's Mort d'Arthur, and I mentioned how disappointed I sometimes felt when, say, Sir Lancelot went out to deliver a helpless lady from some peril or other. Then, just at that point where you can't admire him enough for his selflessness, he explains to someone, as though it was the most natural thing in the world, that he is doing it to win worship, that is, to increase his reputation. We recognized it as an inheritance from paganism. Without intending any embarrassment, I asked Lewis if he was ever aware of the fact that, regardless of his intentions, he was winning worship from his books. He said in a low, still voice, and with the deepest and most complete humility I've ever observed in anyone, "One cannot be too careful not to think of it." The house, the garden, the whole universe seemed hushed for a moment, and then we began talking again. As those poignantly happy months drew to an end, and the time came for me to return to the United States, Lewis and I began planning for his retirement, the books he would write, the duties I would relieve him of, our study together of the old French sources that lie behind Mallory's Mort. Even now, years later, those happy prospects have the power to tease me with such hopes as Lewis's Jill thought of in The Last Battle, when the picture of all those happy years piled up, till it was rather like looking down from a high hill onto a rich, lovely plain full of woods and waters and cornfields, which spread away and away till it got thin and misty from distance. But Lewis died suddenly on the 22nd of November, 1963. At times, when asked about him, I have made it clear that I was with him for only 3 months. But I think I do a disservice to both his memory and his kindness by that word, only. Have we not all felt a lasting bond with someone we have known only minutes, and yet failed, for such is the nature of things, to achieve any intimacy with those we have run into for half an hour or so over a period of years? Make of it what you will. I am ashamed to admit that I once thought that because the plans Lewis and I made together did not run on into the years, I was somehow cheated. If not wicked, it is ungracious. Recently, the grandmother of one of my friends was dying, and I went with him into those delectable peaks of Derbyshire where the people are as free from cant and overstatement as any I know. It was early spring, and there was nothing my friend could find for his grandmother but a few sprigs of pussy willow. As he gave them to her, minutes before she died, she pressed them to her face and whispered, "They're grand, my love, and enough." But of his books, there never seemed enough for Lewis's publishers. Yet, much as Lewis loved to write, never was it, as it is with so many others, zeal not according to knowledge. He had to have something to say before he put pen to paper. Still, although he kept to deadlines set by himself regarding his books, it took the initiative of his English and American publishers to press him into preparing selections of his shorter pieces. Not because Lewis had not put all his effort into such addresses as are found here, but he needed prodding before such selections were made. This volume, consisting originally of the addresses numbered 1, 2, 4, 6, and 7, was published by Geoffrey Bless of London in 1949, under the title Transposition and Other Addresses, and later that same year by Macmillan of New York as The Weight of Glory and Other Addresses. Since that time, the volumes of essays on the two sides of the Atlantic have differed somewhat, and this book is an attempt to put things right. What spurred me into action was a tour I made of the United States in 1979 with the film Through Joy and Beyond, The Life of C.S. Lewis. After the film, I ended the evening by reading aloud a portion of Lewis's Transposition. What I had forgotten, and many nice people reminded me of, was that what I considered one of the most ravishing pieces of prose Lewis ever wrote had been added later and was not therefore in the American version. Although this in itself was enough to justify resetting the text of the book, it occurred to me that it also afforded the ideal occasion for enlarging the volume by three addresses never published in the United States and one never published anywhere before. The addresses are arranged chronologically, except for one, The Weight of Glory, which is so magnificent that not only do I dare to consider it worthy of a place with some of the church fathers, but I fear I should be hanged by Lewis's admirers if it were not given primacy of place. It was preached at the invitation of Canon T.R. Milford at solemn evensong in the 12th century Oxford University Church of St. Mary the Virgin on the 8th of June 1941. To one of the largest congregations ever assembled there in modern times. Canon Milford, who was the vicar of St. Mary's,
told me that the invitation sprang from his reading of Lewis's The Pilgrim's Regress. The sermon was published first in Theology, Volume 43, November 1941, and afterwards as a pamphlet by the SPCK in 1942. 2. Learning in Wartime was also preached at the invitation of Canon Milford at Evensong in St. Mary the Virgin on the 22nd of October 1939. This too was owing to the canon's appreciation of The Pilgrim's Regress, and, as he told me, because with so much unrest caused to Oxford undergraduates by World War II, Lewis, an ex-soldier and Christian don at Magdalen College, was thought to be just the man to put things into the right perspective. It too brought a great crowd to St. Mary's, and Canon Milford arranged for everyone present to be given a mimeographed copy of the sermon bearing the title None Other Gods, Culture in Wartime. Lewis took as his text for the sermon Deuteronomy chapter 26, verse 5. A Syrian ready to perish was my father. It was published that same year in pamphlet form under the title The Christian in Danger by the Student Christian Movement. 3. It was while this book was in preparation that my friend George Sayer, a pupil of Lewis's at Magdalen during the war years and an intimate friend thereafter, sent me a copy of Why I Am Not a Pacifist. The talk was given to a pacifist society in Oxford sometime in 1940, and Lewis made a copy for Mr. Sayer, a most fortuitous event, as the original has not survived. We know that Lewis never made any attempt to publish it, and it appears in print here for the first time. 4. Transposition was preached in the chapel of Mansfield College, Oxford, a congregational institution, at the invitation of its principal, Nathaniel Micklem, 1888 to 1976, on the Feast of Pentecost, the 28th of May 1944. It was reported in the Daily Telegraph of the 2nd of June 1944, under the heading Modern Oxford's Newman, that in the middle of the sermon, Mr. Lewis, under stress of emotion, stopped, saying, "I'm sorry," and left the pulpit. Dr. Micklem, the principal, and the chaplain went to his assistance. After a hymn was sung, Mr. Lewis returned and finished his sermon on a deeply moving note. Lewis has probably accomplished as much as any modern writer, both in his fiction and in his sermons, to make heaven believable. My guess is that at some time, but not necessarily in 1944, he may have felt that he had not succeeded as well as he might with transposition. Though he was quite ill during the spring of 1961, when Jock Gibb, his publisher at Geoffrey Bless, was pressing him to edit a volume of his essays, something wonderful happened. With a simplicity that is perhaps an instance of heaven coming to its own rescue, Lewis was shown what glories are involved by the corruptible putting on incorruption. And there came from his pen an additional portion that raises that sermon to an eminence all its own. This new portion begins on page 107 with the paragraph, "I believe that this doctrine of transposition provides," and concludes on page 111 with the paragraph ending, "They are too flimsy, too transitory, too phantasmal." This extended version of the sermon first appeared in Lewis's They Asked for a Paper, London, 1962. 5. Is Theology Poetry? Was read to the Oxford University Socratic Club on the 6th of November 1944, and was first published in The Socratic Digest, Volume 3, 1945. 6. The Inner Ring was the annual commemoration oration given at King's College, University of London, on the 14th of December 1944. 7. Membership was read to the Society of St. Alban and St. Sergius, Oxford, on the 10th of February 1945, at the invitation of Miss Anne Spalding, an old friend of Charles Williams, as it was in Miss Spalding's parents' home that Williams lived when he moved to Oxford at the outbreak of World War II. The paper was originally published in
Sobernost, number 31, June 1945. 8, On Forgiveness, was written at the request of Father Patrick Kevin Irwin, 1907 to 1965, and sent to him on the 28th of August 1947 for inclusion in Father Irwin's parish magazine of the Church of St. Mary, Sawston, Cambridgeshire. However, Father Irwin was transferred to the Church of St. Augustine, Wisbeach, before it could be published, and I first heard of the essay in 1975, when members of the priest's family deposited the manuscript in the Bodleian Library. It was first published in Lewis's Fernseed and Elephants and Other Essays on Christianity, London, Fount Collins, 1975. 9, A Slip of the Tongue, was the last sermon Lewis preached. It was given at the invitation of the chaplain of Magdalen College, Cambridge, Father C.A. Pierce, in the college chapel at Evensong on the 29th of January 1956. Unlike Magdalen College, Oxford, the Cambridge College is quite small, and its chapel, a perfect little gem by candlelight, is indeed tiny. Even so, the chapel register reveals that it was crowded with so many people, 100, that extra seats had to be brought in. The sermon was published in Screwtape Proposes a Toast and Other Pieces, London, Fount Collins, 1965, which volume Lewis was helping his publisher plan just before he died. I am grateful to Collins Publishers for permission to reprint Is Theology Poetry, On Forgiveness, and A Slip of the Tongue, and to Mr. Sayer for providing me with a copy of Why I Am Not a Pacifist. My thanks also to Owen Barfield for permitting me to edit this book and for all the other things that cause me to regard him as one of those friends who, by any reckoning, is one of the most obvious boasts of our fallen race. Walter Hooper, the 7th of March, 1980, Oxford.